Stand by, all NBC stations. In 1 minute from now, we will feed you this material for recording only. Repeat, for recording only. Because of difficulties in the pickup. The spot runs 19 minutes and 15 seconds. Consists of President Johnson's speech at the University of Rhode Island, where the president discussed civil rights and poverty and warns against violence. In 30 seconds from now, we will feed you this hotline report that is for recording only. Material is not for live broadcast and comes your way 15 seconds from now. Spot runs 19 minutes, 15 seconds. Stand by, all NBC stations. In five seconds, we will feed you this material. This is an NBC News hotline for recording only. Here now is the President Lyndon Johnson's speech this morning at the University of Rhode Island, Kingston, Rhode Island. The spot will be starting in 5 seconds from now.
Dr. Horn, Governor Chafee, Lieutenant Governor of Fort Perry, Rhode Island may be the smallest state in the Union, but it has given us some of our biggest men. And one of them is my favorite keynoter, your most distinguished United States Senator, John Pastore. I'm grateful that I could be here with your junior Senator Claiborne Pell today, who is working so hard. So effectively to fill the shoes of that great, late, lamented statesman, Theodore Francis Green. I'm pleased that I should be accompanied by Congressman Ferdinand St. Germain, a man who has helped as much as any man in Congress to enact one of our most important bills, the Demonstration Cities Bill, which will be one of our strongest weapons in our war on poverty in this nation. And I am too very pleased to recognize a great many other distinguished and patriotic leaders who have come here to be with us on this campus this morning. Governor John King of New Hampshire. Please stand, Governor King. Governor John Bowie of Massachusetts. Senator George D. Aiken of Vermont. Senator Aiken is with us on his birthday, and I wish to Senator Winston Proudy of Vermont. Governor Philip Hoff of Vermont. Senator Mike Mansfield, distinguished majority leader from Montana, and Mrs. Mansfield. Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine. Senator Thomas McIntyre of New Hampshire, and Mrs. McIntyre. And Representative Robert Stafford of Rutland, Vermont. And Representative Stanley R. Tupper of Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. And Representative William Hathaway of Oregon. It's a very special pleasure for me to be in this beautiful state. I have never come here without feeling your very special warmth, and I have never left here without real regret. By now, I seem to be something of a commuter, having campaigned here, having accepted 2 honorary degrees here, and having spent my heart here when the returns came in November 1964. I want to speak to you this morning about our society, about some of the stress that it is undergoing, about what I believe that we must do if we are to preserve civil peace and if we are to serve social justice. If there is a single word that describes our form of society in America, it may be the word voluntary. The American experience has been one long effort to open up new and better choices for our people. Generally, though not universally, we have succeeded. Most men are free to pursue any calling they choose, to do with their lives and their properties what they will. The results are mixed, but the tremendous prosperity that we enjoy and the personal liberty that we cherish are at least good evidence that the American system seems to work. Yet that prosperity will soon collapse, and where it is torn by violence or avarice or carelessness, each of us suffers, not the least him who failed in his responsibility toward the rest of us. Because most people are fair, and most do not, as a moral matter, want to do harm or to take unfair advantage, the fabric of private responsibility holds fast. Yet our society grows, and it grows more and more complex, and the fabric is sometimes strained. Great forces are released that threaten to destroy it. Forces of technology, of population growth, of immense and anonymous institutions. And as the prosperity of the majority becomes more evident, the poverty of the minority becomes more unbearable. People who have been denied basic human rights for centuries begin to demand a share in the society. And the gap between what they want and what they have is boldly revealed. The proud assertions of our democracy are then challenged. To many more fortunate people, the call of the poor minority for justice is the occasion for fear. They believe that it cannot be answered without depriving them of what they possess by birth or hard work. They see political rights and economic well-being as a cake whose size is constant. If the poor minority is granted a piece of it, the share of the affluent majority will be diminished. And in a sense, they're right. If one man, one king or dictator, holds all the political power in a country, granting five people the right to vote and shape their destiny does reduce his power considerably. Granting that right to every man reduces it drastically. Yet we long ago decided that our concept of man's integrity required this sharing of political power. The majority ought to determine the course of the state. We are working now to make that possible in every part of our land. And we're doing it for the first time since slaves set foot on our soil. And we shall succeed. No power on this earth can prevail. Far more difficult, because it is far more widespread and complex, is the question of economic rights. We decided long ago that our economic system should not be controlled by government decree. We chose freedom in the marketplace, just compensation for all, and for all a chance to share in the country's wealth. And if that share can be obtained through the free market, so much the better. But where it is denied to some because of the wretched circumstances of their birth, or the poverty of their education, or the foul environment that surrounds them, the sickness that weakens and the despair that crushes them, we believe that the nation should act. We believe that just as a man has the right to choose those who shall govern the state, so does he have the right to live in a decent environment. So does he have the right to acquire the skills that useful work requires. So does he have the right to secure and to hold a job despite the color of his skin or the region of his birth or the religion of his father. There is a moral as well as a practical basis, I think, for this belief. One of the holy men of our years, Pope John the 23rd, described it in a great message to mankind. And he wrote, "One may take as the ultimate criteria in economic life the interests of individuals or organized groups, nor unregulated competition, nor excessive power on the part of the wealthy, nor the vain honor of the nation, or its desire for domination, or anything of this sort. Rather, it is necessary that economic undertakings be governed by justice and charity as the principal laws of social life." Unquote. Justice and charity both demand that political and economic rights be granted. But justice and charity demand also that political and economic responsibilities be accepted. For our society cannot maintain itself or guarantee justice and fairness to any man where only rights are acknowledged. In the law courts, in the city halls and school boards, in Congress and in the White House, men are constantly trying to balance one man's rights fairly with another's. And this entire work of balancing, of seeking justice between men, rests on the acceptance of responsibility among men. In our system of government, ordinary men and women are required to behave in an extraordinary way. They can express their vigorous dislikes of politicians and policies, but they must allow others to express their equally vigorous approval. They can assert the right to shout, but they must concede to others the right not to listen. So men have the right to protest the condition of their lives, but they also have the responsibility not to injure the person or the property of others in making that protest. Men have the right to seek work wherever they can find it, but they also have the responsibility not to deprive others of their livelihood by violence. Men have the right to use the law, but they also have the responsibility to obey it. This lesson has particular meaning for those who are filled with anger and frustration because of the deprivation of centuries in our own country and throughout our own world. No one needs the law more than they. Yet to many, the law is the symbol of the society which they have been unable to enter, the protector of the status quo, the defender of those who have gouged and who have drained and who have persecuted and who have denied them. They seek to strike out against that society, to bring down the law that is its bulwark. Their mistrust of the law and those it protects is as deep as their despair, as profound as their frustration. Now their demands, once whispered, have risen to a shout, and no one who enjoys the benefit of our society can truthfully say that we have done enough to answer those demands. We have done much in our time. We've done much recently. We've done much in the last 3 years. We're willing to do much more. We know that we must do more. But still, the vicious cycle of poverty persists, hobbling the human personality from generation to generation. If a single act of government or a single program or combination of programs could break that chain overnight, I would recommend it to Congress within the hour of its discovery. But the causes and the conditions of poverty are too deep and too various and too subtle and too firmly interlocked for simple remedies. We deceive ourselves and we deceive the poor as well if we imagine there's some magic sword, some system of federal funds that can cut this chain and cut it with just one stroke. Does this mean that we should not put new billions into schools and into health care and into housing? Of course it does not mean that. What it does mean is that breaking the chain of poverty is going to require patience and time and wise planning and a degree of daring experiment, and the long-term commitment of our immense resources directed by our patriots of all parties and all classes. It means that a major goal of government must be to secure the right to social justice for all of our people, and for all of us to help these people fulfill that right. It means that our laws must be wise and their enforcement must be fair. Yet if all of these are forthcoming, as I genuinely believe they will be, it will avail us nothing if our society is torn and destroyed by violence and by discord. The Molotov cocktail destroys far more than the police car or the pawn shop. It destroys the basis for civil peace and the basis for social progress. The poor suffer twice at the rider's hands. First, when his destructive fury scars their neighborhoods, and second, when the atmosphere of accommodation and consent is changed to one of hostility and resentment. The Negro American has made gains in the past decade behind the banner of peaceful protest. The fury of bigots and bullies to these gains has only served to strengthen the will of the American people that justice be done, because basically we're all a fair people in the United States of America. The vivid contrast between lawful assemblies and lawless mobs has spurred America's conscience. And we have begun to act at last to open real opportunities for the Negro American and other minorities, and to help them move to achieve those opportunities. We shall continue multiplying and enlarging our efforts as we go along. I warn you, they can succeed only in conditions of civil peace. And civil peace can exist only when all men, Negro and white alike, are as dedicated to satisfying their responsibilities as they are dedicated to securing their rights. For we are all, after all, one nation. It is our destiny to succeed or to fail as a single people and not as separate races.
The great Rhode Islander, Roger Williams, described for us really what we are. And I quote, "There goes many a ship to sea, with many hundred souls in one ship, whose weal and woe is common. And this is a true picture of a commonwealth, or a human combination of society. Such was the society of Providence Plantation 3 centuries ago, and such, I believe, is the society of America today." Thank you so very much.
This has been an NBC Hotline for Recording Only.